In this lecture, I'm going to talk about Aristotle's concept of catharsis, which, along with the concept of hamartia, which we'll talk about in the next lecture, has been extremely influential in the history of literary criticism and literary theory. Both concepts are deployed in the Poetics, which doesn't survive in its entirety, but a large portion of it does. And in the part that does survive, Aristotle focuses mainly on tragedy, which is also the genre that we'll be talking about most of the time. Aristotle gives a definition of tragedy at the beginning of chapter 6. And there he says, reading in Margaret Hubbard's translation, which I've given you on a separate handout, he says that a tragedy is a mimesis, that's to say an imitation, of a high complete action. Complete in the sense it implies amplitude. In speech pleasurably enhanced, the different kinds of enhancement occurring in separate sections. In dramatic, not narrative form, effecting through pity and fear the catharsis of such emotions. And you see there that Margaret Hubbard hasn't actually translated the word catharsis, she's just transliterated it from the Greek, that is the Greek word, so as not to beg any questions. She's leaving it open what exactly it means, because as we'll see, that has been a matter of dispute. Whatever exactly catharsis does mean, Aristotle's doctrine of catharsis has often been taken to be a kind of response to Plato's criticism of dramatic art, and in particular tragedy, in the Republic around section 606 or so, where Plato criticizes tragedy for whipping up emotions that are better repressed. And the doctrine of catharsis has often been seen as an attempt to respond to that criticism, although it's not presented explicitly as such, not in the portion of the Poetics that survives. And indeed, this is the only mention we get of catharsis in the Poetics, in the text that survives. And there's no definition of it here. There is something like a definition in a passage in the Politics, which we'll look at shortly, and which seems to bear some kind of relation to this passage, although exactly what relation that is a matter of controversy. We'll come to that in a minute. But just staying with the text in chapter 6 of the Poetics, you see that he says that a tragedy effects through pity and fear the catharsis of such emotions. So such emotions as pity and fear, perhaps not restricted to those emotions. In the Politics passage that we're going to come to in a moment, he groups pity and fear together with what he calls high excitement. So it may be that that's also relevant here too. Now, catharsis in Greek literally means purging. Its central use is in medical texts, where it refers to a process of purging unpleasant humours, unpleasant things that do you harm, can be purged in various ways through an enema, that kind of thing, making you vomit. So there are various medical treatments for getting rid of undesirable alien elements in the body by purging them, by cleansing your body of them. And that's what catharsis literally means. And what you might call the standard interpretation of this text, the traditional interpretation, says that we have that medical sense here as well. So Aristotle has used a medical term, and he means it quite literally, in a medical sense. Going to a tragedy whips up emotions, excites emotions in you, particularly pity and fear. And as we'll see, that means pity for the character or characters undergoing a tragic fate, and fear for oneself, that one might oneself have to undergo that or something similar. So the tragedy excites these emotions. Maybe you can think of it as ratcheting them up to quite a high degree and then purging you of them. And as I say, this is the traditional interpretation, you find it in such commentators as Bernice, Quinton, Nuttall, and for a long time it went unchallenged. But in recent years, a different interpretation has been proposed, according to which catharsis means something like intellectual clarification. And you find this idea in the writings of Golden, Nussbaum, Halliwell, among others. So that here the idea is that the process of catharsis is really a cognitive, intellectual one, not like undergoing a sort of enema, as in the medical interpretation, not a purging in the sense of a cleansing of these emotions like pity and fear, getting them out of your system, but rather the idea is that your mind is directed onto them and you come to some kind of understanding of pity and fear. The emotions are objects, if you like, of an inner gaze that is a cognitive gaze. It's looking for knowledge and it learns something about these emotions. And I guess one of the motives for this more recent interpretation was the thought that the medical interpretation is rather crude. The intellectual interpretation gives Aristotle a more interesting and in some ways a more characteristic doctrine. It's the kind of thing you would have expected him to say, so that it seems, according to the proponents of this interpretation, it seems as though we're filling out something that is unclear in our sources, and we're doing so in an Aristotelian sort of way. And on the intellectual interpretation, the idea would be, just to fill it out a bit more, that pity and fear are not just brute emotions that have no kind of content, no semantic or verbal content. No, they do have a content that can be spelled out in sentences. And they are rational emotions. You can give reasons for why you have them. Somebody says, why do you pity this tragic hero? Or what are you afraid of? You can answer those questions. It's not the case that you would say, well, I simply feel these emotions in me and I can't give any explanation. No, you can rationalize and say what the targets of your emotions are. So they have some kind of propositional content, these emotions, and they arise for reasons which we can theorize about. Spectators can themselves theorize about these emotions. So the emotions, as I say, are not simply brute feelings. They have an intellectual content, a propositional content, and they can be objects of a cognitive gaze and objects of theorizing. They are cognitive states, in fact. And this does indeed fit with what Aristotle says elsewhere about these emotions. In his treatise on rhetoric, for example, he discusses them in some detail. And it's clear that Aristotle's view of them was, as indeed you might expect, that they have content, the content can be spelled out in sentences, they can be rationalized in the way that I've been discussing. You can give reasons for feeling them. So the intellectual clarification view is, as I say, an Aristotelian view in the sense that it's the kind of thing you would have expected him to say. These emotions, pity and fear, have some kind of propositional content. You can think about that content. You can theorize about it. You can maybe learn things from it. And you can achieve, well, the idea of this interpretation is that you can achieve clarification, understanding, so that catharsis is here being used in a metaphorical sense, not a literal purging from the body of some unpleasant alien substance, but clarification in the sense of coming to understand something, namely your emotions. As I say, this interpretation, the motive behind it is really an attempt to give Aristotle a more plausible theory of tragedy than the medical one. We'll come in a minute to talk a bit about why the medical theory is problematic. But the feeling at any rate is that it's too crude, it's open to serious objections, whereas this intellectual interpretation is fully Aristotelian in the sense that it's the kind of thing he might have said, and It's much more interesting. It's much more heavyweight. It would be charitable to Aristotle, this is the idea, to ascribe to him this intellectual interpretation of catharsis rather than the medical one. And it would connect up with the high value that he places on tragedy and that has always been placed on tragedy. I mean, there's always been a tradition in literary criticism and literary theory that tragedy is maybe the highest genre, certainly a genre of great profundity and importance. So you would expect an interpretation of its effect to be correspondingly weighty. And as I say, it's felt by some modern commentators that the medical interpretation simply doesn't cut it in that respect. It gives too simplistic, too crude, too physical, if you like, an analysis of the effect of tragedy. We want something more intellectual. Okay, so those are the two interpretations, the traditional medical one and the more recent intellectual one. Which did Aristotle mean? Well, as I say, he doesn't tell us here in the Poetics, and he doesn't talk about catharsis anywhere else in the surviving part of the Poetics. But, as I've mentioned, he does discuss it in a passage in the Politics, which looks relevant. The question is, how relevant is it? So let's have a look at that passage. And that's also on the handout. So this is on page 133 of Hubbard's translation, where Aristotle says in this passage, "We accept the classification of tunes made by some of the philosophers when they say that some are relevant to character, some to action, and some to high excitement. And also that each of these has a particular musical mode naturally related to it." Ancient musical theory dealt in modes rather than keys, which are a modern phenomenon. We also say that we should use music for several beneficial purposes, not just one. For example, for the education of the young and for catharsis. And then he adds in brackets, "The meaning of catharsis I leave unexpressed at the moment and shall explain more clearly in the Poetics." Well, as we've said, he doesn't in fact do that in the part that survives, but it may well be that he does in one of the bits that doesn't survive. And thirdly, for entertainment, for relaxation and relief from tense effort. Let's pick it up a bit further down. "For the emotions that violently affect some minds are present to all, though with differences of degree. Pity and fear, for instance, and also high excitement, as this too is a disturbance to which some are morbidly subject. We see the effect of sacred music on the latter, when they use the tunes that produce frenzy and are thereby restored to health, finding, as it were, cure and catharsis. The same effect will necessarily follow in the case of those over-inclined to pity, fear and other emotions, in the proportion appropriate to each individual. That is, they all get a sort of catharsis, a relief accompanied by pleasure. Similarly, cathartic melodies give people a harmless enjoyment." Well, the subject in the Politics passage is the effect of music, and it seems clear that here it really is the medical sense of catharsis that is in question. The purging from the body of these emotions which are first excited to a high state of frenzy and then purged, then the body is cleansed of them. You see that he glosses the word catharsis with a relief accompanied by pleasure. And that's the closest we come to any kind of definition of the word in Aristotle's corpus. So that looks fairly clear. He's thinking of these musical modes as having a salutary medical effect on the body, particularly for those who are morbidly subject to pity and fear and high excitement, but also for others as well, he says. And now the question is whether this Politics passage is relevant to the Poetics one. And I mean, I think the answer is it seems plainly relevant to some extent. He even refers to catharsis in the Poetics, so there must be some connection. But supporters of the modern interpretation, the intellectual clarification view of catharsis, say that the relevance is very slight, because Here he's talking about music. He's not talking about drama, and there's a crucial difference between those two, namely, music is without language, so it's not a cognitive form of art, you might say, whereas drama is cognitive. It involves words with meanings, it involves semantic understanding. So supporters of the modern interpretation say the meaning of catharsis is going to be affected by its context. It's got a pretty crude physical medical meaning here in the politics, where he's talking about people working themselves up into a frenzy when listening to music, but it's going to have a different kind of meaning in the context of dramatic art, where the effect of the art goes essentially through the mind, through understanding. You have to understand the words first, as it were, before you can have any response, and that's a crucial difference. So that's one way in which one might try and minimise the relevance of this passage. On the other side of the balance sheet, of course, we do have the fact that he mentions the poetics in this connection. He is using the same concept. He also mentions pity and fear, which are the essential tragic emotions. So that again looks as though it's a point of contact. And although he says these various modes of music that he's talking about are useful for people who are morbidly subject to pity and fear, who have an unnatural tendency towards feeling these emotions, if you like, he also allows that cathartic melodies can be useful for everyone. I mean, there's a sort of natural objection you might make to applying the politics passage here, which is that he's particularly talking about the pathological case, if you like, the case of somebody who is morbidly subject to pity, fear, and high excitement. And there he's saying, well, these melodies are useful, they have a cathartic effect. But if you transfer that over to the case of tragedy without altering anything, then you get the result that tragic art would be particularly directed at the pathological case as well, people who are overexcitable, prone to these emotions of pity and fear. Whereas surely you would want to say, and surely Aristotle would have wanted to say, that tragedy is for everyone, not just for the mentally unbalanced, as it were. But of course, Aristotle does say in this Politics passage that the emotions that violently affect some minds are present to all, though with differences of degree. And again, he says at the end of the passage, cathartic melodies give people, that's to say people in general, a harmless enjoyment. So although in this particular place he's talking about the effect of music on pathological cases in particular, on those who are prone to these emotions, who are in some sense mentally unbalanced, he's leaving the door open to say that everyone has these emotions to some extent and can therefore enjoy the effects of catharsis. So if you said to Aristotle, well, look, this discussion in the politics doesn't seem too relevant to the poetics because everyone goes to tragedy, not just mentally unbalanced people, and you want your theory of tragedy to talk about effects on everyone, not just a small section of the population, I think Aristotle might reply, yes, my theory of tragedy does apply to everyone. Everyone is subject to these emotions to some extent. So in dealing in pity and fear, my theory of tragedy does address itself to everyone. Everyone feels these emotions, and this is according to the medical interpretation, the tragic drama excites these emotions in everyone to a higher pitch and then purges them of it. That would be, as I say, taking the medical line and applying the politics passage as directly as one can, really, to the poetics passage, while recognising that one is talking about music and the other is talking about dramatic art. So one has an intellectual dimension that the other one doesn't. Even so, according to the medical interpretation of the poetics passage, the cathartic effect that he's talking about in both passages is one of being cleansed of certain emotions, to which one is either prone, if one is mentally unbalanced, if one is a pathological case, or which in the course of the music or the drama itself get excited, so that even, as it were, normal people, even balanced people, find that their emotions of pity and fear, which they have anyway, are whipped up, are excited, are cranked up by the either the music, if we're talking about that, or the dramatic art, the tragedy, and then they are purged of these emotions in a catharsis, which is a relief accompanied by pleasure. Now, either way, whichever interpretation of catharsis you take, you can see how a response to Plato might go. Aristotle would be, in effect, saying, well, look, Plato, tragedy is useful. Yes, it does whip up emotions, you're right there, but then it does something useful after that. And then what it does exactly is dependent on which reading of catharsis you take. Either you say, well, it purges you of those emotions, so that's a medically useful effect. Or if you take the intellectual clarification line, you say, well, it has cognitive benefits. It enables you to reflect on and learn things about those emotions. So either way, it serves a practical function. Now, the objection to the medical interpretation in general, the objection to it as a theory of tragedy, and this is something that, as I've hinted once or twice, is motivating the people who go for intellectual clarification as their interpretation of catharsis, because they feel that the medical view is open to a fairly obvious objection, and that it would be charitable to Aristotle not to credit him with an account which was so clearly wrong. What is this obvious objection? Well, it's that the medical account is giving us an effect of tragedy, if you like. It's telling us what effect tragedy has, but it's the wrong kind of effect. We don't want that kind of account. We want an intellectual account. So the clue is in the name, if you like. If the effect of tragedy is a medical one, well, what on earth is the point of going to a tragedy? Why not just go to the doctor instead? Why sit through 2 hours traffic on the stage, or more than that, when you could just go and take an aspirin? If what you want is to achieve some medical effect, then surely there are more direct, more effective ways of doing that than going to the theatre. And it is, you know, on the medical interpretation, it would be an implication of Aristotle's theory that if there were some drug, some pill which was guaranteed to reduce the level of your high excitement, calm you down, purge you in a purely medical sense of your feelings of pity and fear, then it would be preferable to take that treatment rather than go to the theatre. Why go to the theatre and whip up all of these emotions simply in order to be purged of them? You know, if you're an ordinary, well-balanced person, why go through that process in the first place? You're already in a state of calm. You're already in a state of relaxation. So why get yourself into a state of frenzy just in order to get back to a state of relaxation? What's the point of that? That's if you're already a well-balanced person. If, on the other hand, you're one of Aristotle's morbid people, an unbalanced person, then if there's this drug treatment, this pill that you could make use of, that would be a better thing to do, a more effective way of treating the symptoms than going to the theatre. So the objection to the theory is that it's instrumentalist in an implausible way. I mean, instrumentalism isn't always bad, but in this context it would be. The idea is that it would be associating tragic theatre with an extraneous, external end point, one that could be achieved in other ways. Right, that's the point of the label instrumentalist. If you have an instrumentalist view of some activity, then you're thinking of that activity as being engaged in for some purely extraneous end, which could in principle be achieved in other ways, right? And we're all instrumentalists about, you know, certain activities. Certain activities we only engage in, not at all for themselves, but only for what we get out of them at the end. And if you could get the thing out at the end without engaging in the activity, without going through the hassle and the work that maybe you feel you have to, then you would. exercise is a case in point. See, some people engage in exercise not because they enjoy it, they hate it, but because they feel they should, because they want the benefits of exercise. Now, if you came along to them with a wonder pill and said, look, you take this wonder pill and it'll give you all the benefits of exercise and you can stay at home with your feet up, then some people would take that. Others wouldn't, because they're engaging in exercise not just for the end product of health, as Aristotle would say, but also because they enjoy the exercise as an activity. So they're doing it partly for its own sake. And surely what one wants to say here is that going to the tragic theatre, reading tragic literature, if that is to have a point at all, it must be at least to some extent a non-instrumental point. There must be a sense in which you do it for its own sake, because it's worth doing, because you value it as an activity, because it brings you something. Intellectual clarification would certainly be one candidate for the sorts of things that it might bring you. Some kind of understanding, not merely of your own emotions like pity and fear, but, you know, we want to say more broadly of human life, the world, how things work in the world. We value tragic literature so highly because we think it has things to tell us in a very deep way about the nature of human relations, for example. Now, there's an instrumentalist aspect to that. Some, you might say, well, somebody who reads a lot of literature, who engages with a lot of literature, maybe achieves a better understanding of people and is better at interacting with people. I don't know whether that's so, but you might, you know, people have thought that. And that would be a kind of instrumentalist justification for reading literature. But there must also, or maybe even exclusively, be a non-instrumentalist justification, which says, well, it has value in its own terms, and it brings a kind of understanding which you couldn't achieve in other ways, and which is worth having for itself, not for some ulterior end that could in principle be achieved in some other way. So the medical interpretation as a theory of tragedy is open to this fairly obvious objection that many people have made. It seems to be just point missing. If you ask the question, well, what's the point of reading tragic literature? If I say to you, oh, you should read Othello, it's a great play, and you say, well, why? You wouldn't expect me to give a medical response to that. You wouldn't expect me to say something like, oh, well, this will calm you down in the end. It'll get you all worked up first, but it will then calm you down, and that'll be a good feeling. You know, those might be among the effects that it has, but you wouldn't expect me to sort of focus on that as the main reason for reading Othello. You'd expect a more intellectual justification than that. So the medical interpretation, when we just consider the theory of tragedy that it generates, has the disadvantage that it produces this really quite implausible theory of tragedy. And that's why people have felt, oh, well, surely we must do better by Aristotle than land him with this duff theory. That's a view you get, for example, in Jonathan Lear's paper on catharsis. He rejects the medical interpretation because he thinks that it would give Aristotle an unreasonably crude position, far too implausible position, and he wants to apply a kind of principle of charity and arrive at a much more interesting view to ascribe to Aristotle. And that's one way you can go. An alternative way, which I think I probably favour, is to say, well, yes, the medical interpretation does indeed have this drawback, a substantial drawback, namely that it leads to an implausible theory of tragedy. But so far as we can tell from the evidence, it does seem to be the one that Aristotle held. And there I'm assuming, or I'm supposing, that the politics passage is really very relevant and very good evidence for what is going on in the poetics as well. And it seems to me hard to discount the evidence of the politics passage. And in that passage, it seems pretty clear that we are talking about the medical effect of catharsis. He doesn't say anything like, I mean, what the intellectual clarification people would have hoped that he would say is something like, in brackets, oh, of course, I'm just talking about catharsis in this context where we're talking about modes of music and how they get people worked up. It has a rather different sense in the context of dramatic art. That's what they would have liked him to say, but he doesn't say that. He writes as though it's a uniform concept of catharsis. Here's one application of it, where it's applied quite literally in the medical sense of purging. And then he mentions in passing that he's also going to use it in the poetics, and he'll explain its meaning more clearly there. And the implication is that it's the same meaning each time. It's not one concept of catharsis that applies to music and one concept that applies to the effects of poetry. No, it's the same concept applied in two different domains. That seems to be the implication. So that it seems to me the most straightforward reading of all the evidence is the medical one, implausible as the resultant theory is. But I think we can't rescue Aristotle here. So far as we can tell from the evidence, he's committed himself to a rather implausible theory of tragedy. I fully accept that the intellectual clarification theory is one that Aristotle could have held. It's Aristotelian in spirit. And, you know, it may be he did hold it in some version. I mean, if you put it to him and said, well, do you agree with this theory of tragedy? I think it's very likely he would have said, well, yes, I do. But it's not in the passages that survive, at any rate, the theory that he actually gives, I think. There's very little hint of that in the relevant passages. And it is quite a stretch, linguistically, to interpret a word which literally means purging, purifying the body of harmful substances. It's quite a stretch to interpret that linguistically as meaning arriving at a clear understanding of something. That seems quite a long way away. So, you know, I think it's a rather optimistic interpretation of Aristotle, if I can put it that way. It would be nice if it were right, but it seems to me that the evidence is actually against it. And although, as I've said, the medical interpretation has a disadvantage that it lumbers Aristotle with a rather implausible theory, there's an exegetical advantage of it, which I think is quite significant, which I'll mention now because that will serve as a transition to the next topic. When Aristotle comes to talk about the best form of tragedy, which he does in chapters 13 and 14 of the Poetics, the medical interpretation of catharsis, although, as I say, he doesn't mention catharsis there at all, it's not explicitly in the text, but if you take the medical line on catharsis in chapter 6, you have a means of explaining something which is otherwise a bit of a mystery. And it's this, that Aristotle changes his mind between chapters 13 and 14 on the best form of tragedy. So in chapter 13, he thinks that the best form of tragedy is one that ends badly, like the Oedipus, which is the view you'd expect him to take, that most people have taken. But he then in chapter 14 changes his mind and goes for a different form of tragedy as the best, namely one that looks as though it's going to end badly, but at the last minute the situation is rescued and it doesn't. And he gives us examples, a couple of plays by Euripides, the Cresphontes, and the Iphigenia in Tauris. The Cresphontes, we know what happened in it, but it hasn't survived as a play, whereas the Iphigenia has. In the Cresphontes, there's a point at which a mother is about to kill her son with an axe because she doesn't know his true identity. And the situation, as I say, is rescued at the last minute where she's informed of his identity. And similarly, in the Iphigenia in Tauris, Iphigenia is about to sacrifice her brother Orestes, not knowing that it is her brother. And again, the information comes just in time before she plunges in the knife so that she doesn't. Now, these are plays that nowadays we would think of as melodrama rather than tragedy. And it's a lot of people have felt rather disappointed that Aristotle changed his mind from what seems obviously the right view, namely that if we're talking about the genre of tragedy, then yes, I'm afraid it does end badly. That's the nature of tragedy. Why did he first prefer that and then move to preferring melodrama, which, as I say, I think most people would think is not being tragedy at all? Well, an answer to that is provided by the medical cathartic theory, because you could say, well, he changes mind because the melodramatic type of play achieves the cathartic effect, where one's thinking of catharsis in medical terms, better than the Oedipus type of play. I mean, you know, if you think about it realistically and ask the question, well, do you, you know, when you go to a tragedy or read a tragedy, and if it's a very effective performance and you're wrapped up and absorbed by it, or by the text if you're reading it, and you come to the end, you leave the theatre or you close the book, I mean, do you feel purged of emotions of pity and fear? Is that how you would naturally describe your feelings at the end? And there's a certain sense, I think, in which, you know, you don't feel that. You often feel the opposite in a way. You feel that you've been wound up, your emotions have been ratcheted up to a high level, you've been so absorbed, wrapped up in the plot, and then at the end it ends tragically, there's a death, and that doesn't release your feelings at all. In a way, it's a frustrating end, because it's not the end you wanted, in some deep sense, so that you're left with your emotions and you don't really know what to do with them. That, I think, is often the feeling one has at the end of a tragedy. Whereas if you think about the melodramatic case, the cathartic theory is just tailor-made for that, because, you know, you can ratchet up emotions to an even higher pitch in melodrama than you can in genuine tragedy, because you can threaten actions that you couldn't perform on the stage in real tragedy. And this is an important point, which still applies and certainly did apply in Aristotle's day, because Greek tragedy in general did not portray violence on stage. There are one or two exceptions to that, but by and large, violence occurred off stage and was reported on stage by a messenger. Now, where you have a scene, as you do in the Cresphontes, of a mother bending over her son who's lying asleep, and she has an axe in her hand, she thinks he's an enemy, and she's going to kill him, you know, that action is not something that could be shown on the Greek stage. And quite apart from the technical difficulty of it, but even if the technical problem could be overcome, it would offend against the proprieties. It would be too violent to be shown on stage. But the audience, of course, although in one sense they know that, in another sense, they can't see how it can be avoided, because here she is with the axe, her enemy is lying asleep in front of her on a couch, she has a perfect opportunity to kill him, and she's now going to go and do it. So the audience is expecting the violent outcome, and when it doesn't come, the sense of relief is enormous, because the fear, the pity and the fear, if you like, have been cranked up to such an extent, so that correspondingly, when the terrible event doesn't happen, the relief is much greater. So the cathartic effect, you might say, is really much more appropriate to melodrama than it is to genuine tragedy. And maybe that is why Aristotle changed his mind, because in effect he was thinking, I mean, he didn't think this explicitly, doesn't say this explicitly, but in effect you might say what was going through his mind was, well, I've defined tragedy as a genre with a cathartic effect, but hold on, the cathartic effect is much clearer in plays like the Cresphontes, Iphigenia, and Tyrus than it is in the Oedipus. So maybe I should be preferring those. And then in chapter 14, he goes ahead and does so. So the medical theory of catharsis makes good sense of that move, which otherwise is fairly puzzling. It seems fairly puzzling that he would have changed his mind in that way. So it seems to me that is an argument on the side of the medical interpretation, that it does make better sense of that passage. Okay, well, that's all I want to say about catharsis, and I'm now going to move on to talk about another important Aristotelian concept, the concept of hamartia, which has been very influential in the history of European tragedy and theorising about that tragedy. And I suppose you might say there are two questions here. One is what Aristotle exactly meant by hamartia, and how it fitted into his own theory of tragedy. That's one question. And another question is, was he right? Was it a useful concept for him to introduce? Does it illuminate tragedy? Does it illuminate the tragedies that he knew in the Greek tragic tradition, some of which we're familiar with? Does it illuminate tragedies that were put on stage after his death, right down to the present day? So these are all questions that critics have argued about. And they're all controversial, as you can imagine. And we'll be thinking about both questions, both the question what Aristotle meant by hamartia and whether the theory, in one interpretation or another, applies to the actual tragedies that we have in the tradition. So I'll start in this lecture with what Aristotle meant when he talked about tragedy as involving a hamartia. And his mention of it comes in chapter 13 of the Poetics, which I've given you on the handout. The context is that he's discussing various types of plot in tragedy, and he's comparing them in point of excellence. And he comes in chapter 13, so this is about halfway down page 106 of Hubbard's translation. He comes to summarise some of what he's been saying so far, but also he adds new points in this crucial paragraph. He says, "So it is clear that one should not show virtuous men passing from good to bad fortune, since this does not arouse pity or fear, but only a sense of outrage. Nor should one show bad men passing from bad to good fortune, as this is less tragic than anything, since it has none of the necessary requirements. It neither satisfies our human feeling, nor arouses pity and fear. Nor should one show a quite wicked man passing from good to bad fortune. It is true that such an arrangement would satisfy our human feeling, but it would not arouse pity or fear, since the one is felt for someone who comes to grief without deserving it, and the other for someone like us. Pity, that is, for the man who does not deserve his fate, and fear for someone like us. So this event will not arouse pity or fear. So we have left the man between these. He is one who is not preeminent in moral virtue, who passes to bad fortune, not through vice or wickedness, but because of some piece of ignorance, and who is of high repute and great good fortune, like Oedipus and Thyestes and the splendid men of such families." Well, I've read out Hubbard's translation of the relevant passage there, and the bit where hamartia comes is right at the end there, where Aristotle says in her translation that the tragic hero is not preeminent in moral virtue, but passes to bad fortune, not because of vice, but because of some piece of ignorance. And that is her translation of hamartia. What Aristotle actually says there is that the tragic hero undergoes demise, passes to bad fortune, because of a hamartia. That's what the Greek literally says. And unfortunately, she doesn't here just transliterate the word hamartia, as we saw that she did in the case of her translation of the definition of tragedy in chapter 6, where instead of trying to put catharsis into an English word like purification or purgation or something like that, she simply left it in the Greek in recognition of the fact that its meaning is controversial. And it's a pity she didn't do the same here, because the same point applies. In fact, somewhat more so, I would say. It's highly controversial what Aristotle means here by hamartia, and she is prejudging that question by translating it as some piece of ignorance. And it's doubly unfortunate, actually, because it's not actually a possible literal meaning of the Greek. This really is an interpretation. So what the Greek word hamartia literally means is mistake or error, going wrong in some way. And it can be applied to all sorts of things. It's a very common word in Greek, and cognate words are very common. This is quite a different case from catharsis, where we had to look through the medical literature to find out what it might mean. But the word hamartia occurs in all kinds of Greek writing, and it can have all sorts of different connotations. And in particular, most relevantly here, it can have either moral or non-moral connotations. So in some contexts, it means a moral mistake of some sort, something for which you can be held responsible, for which you are culpable. In other contexts, it means a mistake for which you can't really be held responsible, something that you might wish you hadn't done, which you did wrong, but it really wasn't your fault. And hamartia can mean either of these things. There are plenty of examples of each sort of meaning. And indeed, whereas the English word mistake is in a way quite mild, you wouldn't use it of very serious moral transgression. You wouldn't naturally say in English that a mass murderer had made a mistake. Well, you might say that, but it wouldn't, as it were, be your final word on the matter. That wouldn't be the height of your moral criticism in English, at least not naturally so. It's a fairly mild term of censure in English. In the case of hamartia in Greek, it certainly can have that kind of very strong connotation of censure. There are plenty of passages in which people are described as making a mistake, where what is meant is that they're very serious transgressors, and yet the language of hamartia is still used. And as I say, it can range from that at one extreme to a kind of trivial error for which you're not really responsible at the other extreme, and everything in between. So if we're looking to the usage of the word hamartia in other texts and in Aristotle's own texts, because he uses it a lot, not in the Poetics, but certainly in the Ethics, for example, we find that it's used in all sorts of contexts, from moral to non-moral, including very serious and very trivial mistakes. But its basic meaning is mistake, and it doesn't literally mean ignorance. Now, what Hubbard is doing there in translating it as ignorance is she's pushing one interpretation of the word as it's used here, that's to say, the non-moral interpretation. It's a kind of a category mistake on her part, actually, because the point is that one reason why you might make a mistake, why you might commit a hamartia, is ignorance. That is one reason why you might go wrong, because there's something you don't know. And I guess you could argue that that description covered any mistake in some very broad way. I mean, you could even say that the mass murderer of my example above was ignorant in committing mass murder, ignorant of certain moral truths. You can certainly say that. But it's an unnatural, I mean, you know, if you take an example where, I know, your hand slips and you knock over a glass of water, and suppose that has some rather unfortunate consequences. Now, that could be perfectly naturally described in Greek as a hamartia, as a mistake on your part. But it's not something you did as a result of any kind of ignorance. It was an involuntary movement, if you like. I mean, it still counts as an action of yours. You might well not be held responsible for it if it was just some nervous reaction or, you know, some knee-jerk reaction which wasn't deliberate on your part. So you wouldn't necessarily be culpable, but it would still be an action of yours. And ignorance and knowledge have simply got nothing to do with it. They're not in the same ballpark. So it really is a category error on her part to translate hamartia as ignorance. It's a category error because that is one possible cause of hamartia. It's not hamartia in itself. So this is a point you need to bear in mind. I mean, you may ask, well, why am I using Hubbard's translation when she so badly mistranslates that word? Well, the fact is, in other respects, it's an excellent translation. It's got good footnotes. I mean, in most respects, it's a really very good translation. And she does transliterate other Greek words like mimesis and catharsis. I just think it's a pity she didn't follow that policy here. But as long as we know what's going on, no harm done. So my first point in response to the translation that I've read out is, don't simply take her translation of Hamartia there towards the bottom of the page as some piece of ignorance. Don't simply take that as gospel. That's her imposing a particular interpretation on it. I mean, she's probably doing that because she's thinking of ignorance as non-culpable, and she's wanting to push the line, which many people take, that Hamartia here in Aristotle does mean some kind of mistake which is not your fault, for which you can't be held responsible. A lot of people who want to interpret the Oedipus in that way, namely to say that Oedipus is not responsible for his crucial actions, the ones that bring about the tragedy, they often support their position by saying, well, look, it fits in with Aristotle's theory of tragedy because Aristotle had a non-moral conception of the crucial actions performed by the tragic hero or heroine. He thought of them in terms of Hamartia in Poetics 13, and Hamartia there is not a moral concept. That's a kind of constellation of views you get quite commonly, and that will be her position. And in fact, she explains in a long footnote there why she's picked the translation she has. And you can see that that is what is motivating her. It's essentially a going wrong that is venial in her view, that's to say pardonable. And because in some of the key examples, like the Oedipus, this happens in her view as a result of ignorance, she's then imported that into the text and just translated Hamartia as ignorance. But as I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, not only is that a category mistake, but it's also, it doesn't actually achieve what she wants to achieve, because what she's ignoring is the fact that ignorance doesn't have to be venial. She's thinking of ignorance as a category of mistake for which you can't be held responsible. If you don't know something and you perform an action on the basis of that ignorance, you can't be to blame. That's what she's thinking. But that's, of course, nonsense. There are plenty of cases in which you are responsible for being ignorant, and it is thoroughly blameworthy. You know, we have duties to inform ourselves of things. And if we don't do that, if we are ignorant when we should know something, then you are responsible for that ignorance. You are to blame. You know, that's recognized in legal systems as well as in ordinary morality. There are some things that you just should know. And there are some things you should get to know if you don't already know them. So to go back to the Oedipus case that she mentions, it's not the end of the matter to say, oh, Oedipus didn't know what he was doing when he married his mother and killed his father. Maybe he should have known. Maybe he should have worked it out. Right, I won't say any more about that now. We'll come back to that point later. But all I'm saying now is that just categorizing something as ignorance doesn't absolve the ignoramus from blame. Not at all. It depends on the nature of the ignorance. Right? If it's something that you should have known, then you can certainly be to blame for your lack of knowledge. But I think what she had in mind when she translated Hamartia as ignorance was the thought that you can't be held responsible for ignorance, and that we want some kind of word with that meaning to translate Hamartia, because in her view, Hamartia is, as she says, a venial, a pardonable going wrong, something for which you're not to blame. So I think that translation and her reasons for it, given in that footnote, are a complete mess. And it would have been much better if she'd left the word transliterated and then left it to us, as it were, to make up our own minds what it meant and whether it's moral or non-moral and what the best translation of it would be. Well, let's come to that question now, whether it is moral or non-moral, because that is the key issue of dispute. Does Aristotle mean a mistake for which you can be held responsible, or one for which you can't be held responsible? Is the tragic hero or heroine to blame for his or her fate, or not? And people line up on both sides of this debate, and as I say, as I said at the beginning, that you know the debate is often conducted in terms of what exactly is hamartia, what did Aristotle mean, what should he have meant? So that's why this passage has been so influential. I mean, it's a key question, really, when reading tragic literature, to what extent the hero or heroine brings about his or her own demise, to what extent it's a matter of fate or bad luck, and to what extent people are in control of their lives or not. These are key questions that are explored by the genre of tragedy. So what I'm going to do now is try and persuade you that the moral interpretation is the correct one here. In other words, when Aristotle says that the tragic hero falls because of some mistake, that at least includes moral mistakes. So going wrong morally, going wrong in a way that incurs blame, incurs responsibility. And my reason for thinking that that is the sense here, even though he doesn't say so explicitly, is that I think that is what makes best sense of the passage as a whole. I mean, if you look back to the earlier part of it that we read out, he's saying in the earlier part of the passage that the tragic hero should not be either preeminently good or preeminently bad, not wicked, but not a saint either, not a saint and not a devil, somebody intermediate. And what he says is the tragic hero must be one of these intermediate people and falls through a mistake. Now, somebody who says that, somebody who says what I've just said, the tragic hero is morally intermediate in the middle and comes to grief because of a mistake. If you say that, you're not explicitly saying, you're not saying in so many words, that the morally intermediate status of this agent is connected to the mistake, that they are two sides of the same coin, or that they're, you're not explicitly saying that they're in any way related, right? But, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that that must be what's intended. Otherwise, why? Why insist on the morally intermediate status of the hero? If the mistake has got nothing to do with that morally intermediate status, then, for one thing, it's not a very economical theory of tragedy. You'd expect the bits to fit together rather better than that. And for another, it would lack a rationale which it would have if the mistake were connected to the morally intermediate status. In other words, if the mistake arises from the fact that this person is not a saint, is not perfect, has got faults of character, if that is why the tragic hero or heroine makes a mistake, then we have the bits fitting together in a comprehensible way. The mistake then flows from the character. And that's why it makes sense to insist, as Aristotle does, on the agents having that character. You see, in the earlier part, he says, well, you know, we don't want a saint, as it were. We don't want somebody who's purely virtuous, passing from good to bad fortune, because that would occasion outrage. And why would it occasion outrage? Why does he say that? Well, and here we have to bring in a part that I haven't mentioned, I haven't read out, but you can see it on the handout, which is in chapter 9 of the Poetics. He insists that tragedies must display relations of probability and necessity in their plots. That's to say, the events of the tragedy must pan out according to probability and necessity. They must follow in some comprehensible, rational way. They shouldn't just be arbitrary, random events that don't have any connection with one another. They should make sense as a narrative sequence. Each stage should determine or at least make sense of the next stage. And so I suggest that the reason why he thinks that it would occasion outrage to show a virtuous person passing from good to bad fortune is that there would be a lack there, there would be a deficit of explanation. There would be no connection between the person's character and his or her fortune. The mistake then really would have to be of a rather trivial nature in one sense. That's to say, it would have to be almost an involuntary action which wasn't planned by the agent, which wasn't understood by the agent maybe, for which the agent can't be held responsible. It would have to be something like that, an almost coincidental mistake. Or maybe there might be no mistake at all. The play might just show this purely virtuous person being flattened by fate. But either way, there would be a deficit of explanation, an explanatory deficit, as I'm saying. You wouldn't be able to explain the catastrophe in terms of the agent's character. There wouldn't be a natural sequence of cause and effect. And I suggest that the same would apply, and here I'm going beyond the text, of course, but my reading of this is that the same would apply in the case where you had your intermediate tragic hero, that's to say somebody who isn't preeminent in virtue, falling as a result of a mistake which had nothing to do with the degree to which he fell away from virtue. So, in other words, was again quite coincidental, quite accidental to his or her moral character. Something entirely adventitious, something that doesn't relate organically to the sense in which this person is morally intermediate. It would be just something added on, tacked on as an extra, which didn't cohere with the agent's character. And I would have thought that that would be equally outrageous for Aristotle, for the same reason, that there wouldn't be an explanatory link between the agent's fall, the tragedy, and the agent's character. So it seems to me the most economical interpretation of Aristotle's text is to say, well, although he doesn't explicitly say that the hamartia, the mistake, arises out of the agent's character and out of the fact that that character is not perfect, that the agent has faults. Although he doesn't say that explicitly, that must be, I think, his intended meaning. You might say the mistake, the hamartia, measures the moral distance between a perfect agent and this agent that we're talking about. It, how far does this agent fall away from perfection? Well, that is, as it were, tracked by, measured by, the hamartia that he or she commits. One might even go further and say it's because of that very hamartia that the agent isn't perfect. Or rather, putting it more accurately, because hamartia is an action, not a character trait. It's a mistaken action. So it's, if you like, just one case of the sense in which this person falls away from the ideal. It's one exemplification of that. So it arises from a character that falls away from the ideal, falls away from perfection. And the hamartia shows you, you the spectator, how that is, how that works. It's because the agent, the tragic agent, has that deficient character that he or she commits this kind of mistake. That would be the idea. And an important point just to put in here in brackets, as it were, is the thing I was talking about a minute ago when I said that a hamartia is an action. One of Aristotle's commentators translated it as tragic flaw, as flaw of character, and you may well have heard of the phrase tragic flaw. People often teach Shakespeare, for example, in terms of that category, what is Othello's tragic flaw, what is Macbeth's tragic flaw. And it's important to be aware that that can't be a literal translation of hamartia, because again, that would be a category error. A flaw of character is an agent's disposition. It's a property of an agent, a property of an agent's moral nature. It's not an action, right? A flaw is not an action. So tragic flaw is not the right translation of hamartia. But the idea of a tragic flaw, I think, is not thereby impugned. The point is that although a tragic flaw isn't identical with a hamartia, the one being a disposition and the other being an action, the action flows from the disposition. It's because the tragic agent has this particular flaw that this particular mistake is committed, that this action flows from that flaw. The flaw explains the action. So a tragic flaw is not what a hamartia is, but it is what explains a hamartia. That way of putting things is, I think, perfectly acceptable, even if you think that character is not some underlying state that exists in the absence of actions, but is rather something that is constituted out of your actions. So to think of somebody's character is to think of their actions, and the character is, as it were, an assembly of the different aspects of their actions. Some people want to think of character in that way rather than as a sort of deep underlying source of action which would exist even in the absence of action. They want to think of character as a kind of construct, right, to use a standard philosophical way of thinking, something that is constructed out of actions. That's fine, that might be the right way to think of the relationship between character and action, but you can still quite reasonably talk about action as flowing from character on that model, because what you would mean is simply that, you know, if you say, well, he ran away from the battle line because he's a coward, you know, you could be saying something like, that's the kind of action that he regularly performs. In a way, you're not delving below the level of the action itself to find some underlying wellspring which explains that particular action. You're simply fitting it into a pattern of other actions which are similar. But to fit something into a pattern is a recognized form of explanation. So to say somebody does something, he runs away from the battle line because he's a coward, where what you mean by he is a coward is simply, well, look, on other occasions he's done the same thing. That is a form of explanation. It does explain, in some sense, a single phenomenon if you're able to fit it into a pattern of other phenomena. So you wouldn't, on this view, you know, you wouldn't expect to be able to investigate this person's brain, find a little bit of it which is cowardly and which explains all of these cowardly actions. It wouldn't be a cause and effect thing in that sense. It would be an explanation more along the lines of when people say something like, well, this is how it's done, and the reason why you do it this way is because that's how it's always done, right? You know, we always do it this way, so that's why you need to do it this way here too. You're not giving an underlying reason why you should do it in that way, you're just fitting it into a general pattern. And the same might be going on here. In other words, when we're talking about character and actions flowing from character, that's not intended, or at least I'm not intending that, in an ontologically very heavy way, in the sense that there's a sort of ontological level at which there is such a thing as character, and out of that, as an effect follows a cause, you get certain actions. It may be that character is just, as I say, a construction out of actions, so that your character is constituted by what actions you perform. But even if that is right, it still makes sense to say that I did such and such because of my character. For the reason, as I've mentioned, that one's in effect just fitting my individual action there into a network, into a pattern of other actions. And that does, in some sense, go towards explaining it. Okay, well, that's what I have to say about the meaning of the word hamartia in the Poetics, in this chapter on excellence in tragedy, chapter 13. But as I mentioned earlier, the whole question of what it is and what it's for and whether it's a useful concept in discussing tragedy is wrapped up not merely in Aristotelian exegesis, but in discussion of the European tradition of tragedy generally, and the question to what extent does your theory of tragedy, if you're making use of the notion of hamartia, to what extent does it fit the actual tragedies that we have under various possible interpretations of the meaning of hamartia? So if you treat hamartia, as I do, as a moral notion, does that fit the actual tragedies we have? Or is it better, as some critics say, to treat, whatever Aristotle may have meant by it, to treat hamartia as a non-moral notion on the grounds that that fits the actual tragedies, the Greek tragedies, the tragedies in the European tradition, better? And of course, people who think that that is the case, that a non-moral notion of hamartia fits particularly Greek tragedy better, they're likely to say that Aristotle had that view, because of course Aristotle was much closer than we are to Greek tragedy. He knew a lot more of them than we do. We only have about 3% of the tragedies that were performed in the 5th and 4th century. And Aristotle, who is in the latter half of the 4th century BC, at least was in a position to be familiar with a very great deal more of it than that. And he obviously was from the Poetics. He refers to a lot of tragedies, some of which we don't have anymore. But he obviously was pretty familiar with a lot of tragedy. So, you know, you want to accord his view a certain degree of respect because he knew a great deal more of it than we do. So if you know, as is usual when one's interpreting philosophers, one applies a principle of charity, as I said last time. And if you decide that the non-moral sense of hamartia is really the one that fits the Greek tragedies that we have, you're going to feel a tug in the direction of interpreting Aristotle in that way to make it fit, so that he thinks that too. However you interpret hamartia, it would be odd to end up with the conclusion that Aristotle was completely wrong about Greek tragedy. I mean, a number of people have said, well, he might have been right about Greek tragedy, but he's completely wrong about subsequent tragedy, particularly Shakespeare. A lot of critics have said that. And that's another question. But it would certainly be odd to conclude that he was thoroughly wrong about the tragedy he was familiar with and more familiar with than we are. I mean, it could still be right that he was wrong about it. He wasn't infallible, of course. But you'd want that position to be a kind of last resort. If possible, you're going to want your interpretation of hamartia in Aristotle and as applied to the extant Greek tragedies, the ones we have. You're going to want those two things to mesh so that they fit together quite well. And if you do ascribe a mistake at some point to Aristotle, then you're going to want to be able to explain that. But obviously one reasonable strategy for trying to work out what Aristotle meant by hamartia is looking at the actual Greek tragedies that we have and seeing what theory best would fit them, and then seeing if Aristotle's text can be made to yield that. That's, as I say, a charitable way to approach the topic. And to some extent, we'll be doing that when we look at the Oedipus and the Antigone, two of the great Greek tragedies, which we'll do over the next couple of weeks. One of the questions we'll be asking will be, well, do these tragedies exemplify mistakes of either a moral or non-moral sort? And I mean, clearly things go wrong in both of these tragedies, but why do they go wrong? And is there anyone to blame for their going wrong? And what is the nature of the error, if there is one? And since Aristotle explicitly mentions Oedipus here, and quite often indeed in the Poetics, it makes good sense to look particularly at that tragedy, and that's what we'll be doing next time round.